Hello.
Hello. Hey.
Hi,
Hello.
how are you?
Good.
Good. There's something funky again with Skype because until I joined the call, I didn't see the green buttons on
What
either one
green
of your names.
buttons?
The little green circle saying that you're on online.
Oh yeah. That's been broke for a long time.
Yeah, it seems to work on and off for me, but
It seems to refresh once you've had a conversation or
oh,
something.
okay. That's weird.
Yeah, I guess the pinging doesn't work as well as it used to.
Yeah.
I think they turn it off if you go to m too many birthday parties.
There you go. You've been in birthday party mode and like all kinds of crap lately, Rob.
There's a million birthdays in our family. Our entire both sides of our family start in September, mid-September, and end at the end of March. We literally have no one on either side of our of our family from April until the middle of March, middle of September. So it's just nonstop,
Ah.
especially this time of the year, January, February, March. There's tons of birthdays.
Nice.
Yeah, we have a lot of condensed in March and April.
Yeah.
But
And then one of the Sundays was Easter, so we had family over and stuff. You know what good Catholics we are. So
yeah, did you have an Easter egg hunt?
we did.
Did you find anything?
No, the kids did though.
You didn't find the one egg that had like a 20 in it?
I wasn't allowed to participate. Unfortunately.
That we used to my parents used to do the hard boiled eggs, right? But then they would have those eggs that you break open, the plastic ones
Yeah,
that
the
have
plastic one, yeah.
stuff.
Yeah.
Well, there was some money incentives, like you could find the money eggs.
Yeah.
And
I mean
some of
that's
them
the
had
good
a
stuff.
some of them had a quarter, some of them had a dollar, some of them had $5, but then if you hit the $20, you were like, wow. Yeah.
Hit the jackpot.
Yeah,
Yeah, so it's been a while. I haven't looks like I haven't joined you guys since the end of March 20th.
you don't you sound like a rookie again, like you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is this on?
Yeah, it's a guest Rob Krieger.
That's been even longer since all three of us were on.
Oh, well, that was back, I think, 2017.
It itself is retro.
Exactly.
Go.
Yeah.
You've
How
been
have you guys
watching a
been?
lot of weird movies there, Rob. What is that
Me?
M? That
What do
M?
you mean?
I never heard of it.
A famous movie. Famous movie. German movie from 1931.
Is it
Yeah.
subtitled or what?
Oh yes. Well, unless you know German.
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
I've
It
never.
was I was extremely impressed being that it's 1931. The film technique, Fritz Lang, he was a famous German director.
Yeah, I've
He
heard
did
the name.
Metropolis too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I never saw Metropolis, but just like techniques and stuff that he used in his filmmaking that I would consider, I mean, that we see all the time now, I was surprised to see back in 1931. Like he had two different kind of interviews going on, two different scenes, and two people talking in two different areas. So like one person would ask a question and then he would cut to the other scene and hear the person answer the question from the other scene, and then he'd reply back, and he kept going back and forth between the scenes, because basically indicating that both parties are saying the same thing in two different areas, and it was just it, I'm like, not that it's so crazy to see nowadays, but like in 1931 he was already doing like stuff like that, and it was just really good Peter Lorre, he's famous for playing all these like kind of creepy guys in the 30s and I think even into the 40s. He was in Casablanca. I don't think he was called Igor, but he played like the Igor role in some of the later Frankenstein movies.
Was it Quasimodo? Or
Maybe, I don't
Or that's
remember.
the Hunchback, right?
Yeah, but he definitely so he was a child murderer in M. He was the only name that like I recognized from the movie, but
His
again,
name's
in that
pretty
Germany.
famous because I recognize both those names.
Yeah.
So I and I, I've
Wasn't he in
never
that
heard
one
I've never heard
movie
of him.
I talked about? Wasn't he in Arsenic and Old Lace? Wasn't that him?
Yeah, I think he was in that too. He's got the very distinct, I mean, his
Creepy
face is
doctor.
distinctive. Yes, his voice is distinctive.
Yeah.
He has a very creepy sounding voice when he wants to use that type of tone. I can't. I would love to try to duplicate it, but I don't think I would. I'd be able to do it. But yeah, it was pretty good. I was impressed, especially for 1931.
Yeah, do you find you have to almost keep reminding yourself in order to, when it was made, to sort of appreciate the innovations when they're th something that's like, I know when we watch Citizen Kane, like a lot of the reasons that that is so heralded is because of the things that it innovated. And there are things that have just have been imitated and reused for decades now. So we're really used to seeing it. So it's almost you have to keep reminding yourself, no, this is like
This blew people away at the time.
yeah, he innovated this thing that I've seen over and over again. That's yeah.
Yeah, it's because of Citizen Kane or it's because of whatever that you're so used to seeing it now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. There are some movies that legitimately I think are just fantastic movies, even older ones.
Sure.
But like certain like for sure was one where I was like trying to put myself in the time frame of this was like very early into, I think the 30s are probably the beginning of any type of film that holds up, that people look to even today. I think anything before that was just so primitive that I don't think it's considered, very impressive. But yeah, I have to put myself in the shoes of, okay, this was 1931 in Germany. Really, really cool filmmaking. So yeah, it was a lot of fun to watch. The other one that I watched, Mike, was a brand new movie. It was also subtitled. I don't remember if it was, I can't remember where it was now. But that was a cool one. It's almost like a 28 Days Later type of a movie.
Was
Oh, it was I think it was a set in Spain, if I'm remembering
the
correctly.
M a horror movie listed in your book or
It
what?
is. It is. I
Okay,
mean,
yeah.
it's definitely more on the side of suspense than any type of horror, but it is in my book, yes.
Well, suspense to me is a brand of horror. It could be.
It could be, yeah. Like, I don't think there was anything
Well,
scary
it's a
about the
serial
movie.
killer, right?
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, yes,
Well,
but
anytime there's a serial killer, there's that could be horror.
it could be, and I'm sure again for the time that it was kind of scary to watch. Like, I don't think anyone would be scared watching it now.
Don't
Not
think you have
after
to be
movies like
scared to
Seven.
watch a horror. I wasn't scared when I watched the new Scream. I wasn't scared.
You weren't scared.
Well, I'm not scared when I watch most movies.
I know. I've never. I'm usually not scared
It's
That
hard to
is true.
get like scared anymore, like truly terrified.
Every once in a while, I'll see a movie that just sends chills like up my like a certain scene. It usually doesn't sustain through a movie, but a certain scene might put a chill up my spine, and that's the feeling that I'm always looking for. Like something that just kind of like, oh my God.
The other day, I was just bagging and boarding comics, and I saw there was another Fright Night movie I hadn't seen. I'm like, how did this go past me? So
New or old?
It was 2000 something. It was
Okay.
right after the remake, but it had like
Oh, okay.
totally different actors, and it was very generic, but I still wanted to see it because I love the Fright Night.
Yeah.
I thought you were starting a story about a time that you really were scared.
No,
Like you were
I
gonna
haven't
say
been
like
scared in a while.
I thought you were gonna say like you realized you had run out of bags or something.
Yeah, that is terrifying.
That is terrifying.
Even Harley's scared.
Yeah.
Yeah. She didn't want to hear about that.
It's like a Sunday ritual every time I podcast now. It's like I'm gonna
Yeah,
start yelling. Barb's still asleep, and I'm just gonna start yelling.
she's got stuff to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I've watched a few good ones.
We are getting
Those
rid
were
of my
both pretty.
baby today, which is very sad.
Oh, your car, not your
Yeah.
dog.
Yeah, the cost of repairs just exceeded the what its value is to a pretty
Yeah.
good point. So it's like, God, it's hard though, because I want to fix it. I love that thing. I've never loved a car before. This is the first one I've ever loved.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
don't know if
It's the
I'm
Durango
not
that took
touched.
us to the peak, Chris.
Oh, okay. So I've been in that car.
Yeah.
Chris doesn't sound all that impressed. He's like, oh, all right.
Or I mean,
what? No,
I
did
held my
we?
heart back
Wait,
because I knew
we
she was
did.
already promised to another.
We did. We did drive to the peak with you, right? Or am I thinking Micah? I can't remember who it was.
We went no or we went to Garden of the Gods.
Oh yeah, it was probably Micah then. Micah and Claire, we drove up the peak. That was scary.
Yeah, he was talking
I don't
about
want
it
to ever
about
do
with
that again.
acids.
And on the way down, our brakes overheated because they check your temperature when you're coming down the mountain, and they make you stop if they're above a certain temperature.
Oh
My God.
wow.
Yeah.
What is the angle of incline?
I don't know, man.
I mean,
It's pretty
it's got to be
60,
more than
70.
45, right?
Yeah, it's pretty high.
My God,
Especially
I would
towards the top. Once you pass the tree line, it's pretty high. It
I
looks
would
like you're driving off
freak
the
out.
mountain, like you can't see anything.
Yeah. 90 degrees. Straight down.
They just tie a winch to your back bumper and lower you down.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Better not be
That's
rusted.
right. It was Micah because we spent, you know, when we go to the peak, we usually take the train, but the train wasn't running. And we drove up and we spent, I guess, way longer than we usually spend. Like, usually you take the train and you got like, I don't know, 50 minutes of free time, and then you take the train back down. And since we drove up, we were up there like 2 hours and 30 minutes or something. And
Oh, wow.
after about the first hour, I think it was an hour, we all started to have heart attack symptoms where we were like, what the fuck just
Well, you
hit
couldn't
us?
breathe because of not
Yeah,
being able to
Micah. Yeah,
breathe.
the altitude got to us.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And yeah, Micah and everybody was like, what is happening? We need to sit down for a while. What the hell? Yeah, that's pretty crazy. Because we never been up there that long.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sounds like a fun time. Almost die, up there, almost die coming down.
Yeah. That's because they got rodents, these marmots or whatever they're called, and Barb didn't want to run one over, so it felt like we're going to go off the cliff. Just weaving and
That's scary.
yeah.
Yeah, I think I would have remembered that
Yeah.
Oh man.
But I gotta clean her out today and take her to. We're we're giving it to one of Barb's coworkers, so
Oh, really?
he's a mechanic. He's gonna fix it. He's gonna
Mm.
give it to his kid, so it's weird to like a car more than your new car. Like, it's just, I find that really bizarre, but I do.
How's your neighbor?
Our new neighbor?
Your neighbor with the COVID, is he all better?
Oh, he's better. Yeah, he's better. He finally is off the oxygen
That's good.
after like 3 months. But he had to
Yeah.
like rehab his lungs. Like, he had to build them up, build them up, build them up, with a physical therapist.
Wow.
Yep.
You just never know.
The other neighbors are moving out. We had to like fix our fence, just to, 'cause we're getting the whole fence knocked down like in 2 weeks. But it we had some high winds and it damaged it, and me and Barb kind of like just put like wire and all kinds of crap just to hold it up.
Yeah.
And then there the whoever's renting the house came and fixed it, and I'm like, what the fuck? They took all away our stuff, and then whatever they did, they're gonna tear down anyway, so hopefully they didn't put another post in with cement. But I guess they'll just jackhammer that shit out.
It's been you're saying about the wind. It's been so windy, and I don't know if you. I mean, I don't know how different houses are across the country, but like at the peak of our house is like this little square like vent that I don't know if there's a name for the vent, but it's a little square vent on each side of
Yeah,
the peak.
yeah.
Okay. Well, in the last windstorm that we had about a week and a
Of
half
you
ago.
mean an attic vent?
Yeah,
Like, yeah.
but there's no actual attic. It's probably only above the second floor. It's probably only like a couple feet high. But yeah,
Yeah,
that.
they're attics that are not really meant for storage, but they're the
Yes.
truss where the truss is for the house.
Exactly
Like,
right.
yeah, so it's space.
So this thing, it just blew away. It just blew out. So this big hole, empty square hole up there. We went and a neighbor has a he has a home remodeling business. We asked him if he could take a look, get a ladder, and he said he was going to replace both sides, but then he never showed up. So Steve's going to call him back and see if he's still willing to do that for us or not. But yeah, it's like all this stuff is just like I don't know, Chris. We're near each other. I mean, it seems like the wind has been getting more often stronger. Like it used to be once in a blue moon, and you'd have like crazy windstorms, but now it's pretty normal.
For us, it's wind and drought. Like, we haven't had any like moisture whatsoever.
Oh, wow.
And just dry, dry, and fires everywhere, and
Well,
yeah,
we've
it's very
had a fair
bizarre.
amount on moisture, I think.
Yep.
Wind or snow.
I
I
think
mean,
the dryness
snow or
is in the
rain.
West Coast.
Yeah, usually the case, seems like.
Yeah, we've been lucky with not having to worry about droughts for the most part.
No, that's not something we run into much.
All right. Well, let's kick this one off. Who wants to go first?
I'm eating a muffin.
Oh, so you want to go second or third then?
Yeah, I'll defer.
All right, well, I'll go first.
Okay.
Since no one's biting at the bit.
You beat me by like 2 seconds.
I'm gonna talk about one of books that me and Rob talked about. I'm going into the second issue of Tarot by Jim Ballant from Broadsword Comics. Well, in the first issue, Raven Hex hired these two dudes to grave rob a corpse. And what she's up to is no good. She wants to bring back her dad. So this gives the origin story of Tarot's family, how they're a family of witches, and also gives the origin of Skeleton Man. Skeleton Man was in the grave site, protecting the ghost of these two twins that are joined. I forget what they call them. What do they call the Siamese twins? He was protecting the grave of them when their corpses had been robbed by Raven Hex. Raven Hex hired these guys to go take the body for whatever reason. I think it's to bring back the father. She needs to have a spell to do that. So, Skeleton Boy, I thought was in the first issue, I thought he was dead. Like, I didn't think he was like anything in human form because he didn't look like it. Like, he didn't look like he was wearing a mask or anything. He looked like a supernatural corpse. Well, he's injured really bad in here, which kind of indicates that he's not supernatural. And Taro takes him to her place to patch him up, and it gives his origin story where he was just on a car ride with his girlfriend and his dog, and they were teenagers, and they crashed the car. And since that crash, he's sort of come back, but he's dead, and his girlfriend died, and she's at that cemetery that he was protecting, and she's pretty gorgeous. I mean, she looks like a skeleton, something out of Return of the Living Dead. You know how you have those sexy zombies, but she's not a zombie. She's more of a ghost. But you
Was
could,
she the one that like kind of glows blue?
yeah. Did you read
Okay.
number two?
No. But I bought those ones that from his website. I haven't read them yet, but I've
Yeah,
seen
she
all the
grows
pictures.
blue, and if you look, she looks like translucent. Like you could see her skeleton pieces in certain areas. But she wears like a punk rock outfit. She's got crosses on her boobs. She seems jealous because the two twins say she left with the witch, a beautiful witch, and she's questioning stuff. So I think that's a plot line that's gonna happen, work its way out. And there's a scene where it shows Skeleton Boy and Taro kissing, but it's sort of a dream of his because he like wakes up. He finds himself, this is when you know he's human, he finds himself like wrapped around the ribs, and he's wearing his tiny whiteies, which have like, I don't know what are on his underwear. It looks like little cheese pieces. I don't know what's going on. But he's got his some kind of underoos on. I don't know what's going on. But he wakes up, he finds Tarot naked, of course, in the taking a bath. She doesn't even like she's like, I don't need to cover myself up or anything. She's not shy. And he's wearing her robe. And they start talking about Tarot's family. So Tarot and had a mother and father who were witches. And her and her sister Raven grew up raised as witches, and then they were sort of traumatized later as kids. Like they would get picked on at school, they got kicked out of school. So the father became enraged and sent demons upon everybody, and he destroyed the school and later was killed. And ever since then, Raven was like, oh, I hate humans. Like, these kids are awful. So she's a very vengeful child, and Tarot was raised by her mother, and she's wants to be a pure witch. But you kind of feel for Raven too, 'cause I don't blame her for wanting to bring her father back and kind of destroy humanity. She's bitter because there were girls when this happened. But yeah, it gives these stories, and for whatever reason, Taro needs Skeleton Boy to track where Raven took the corpse. And he says he doesn't have the ability to track, but the ghosts do. So he can go back to the graveyard and be able to track where the corpse was taken from. So that's how they're going to team up and try to find Raven Hex. Really good art. I think the story is pretty cool. I'm really enjoying that. Did you ever get your tarot books yet? Are you
Yeah, I
still
got
waiting?
them. I haven't read them yet. I've got whatever it was, like 7 or 8 of them up until like whoever was the most recent
Well,
issue.
I was curious if you had a good experience ordering from their website, so
Yeah,
yeah.
it like it, you know, it took a little while. It's not like, you know,
Lightning fast, yeah.
yeah, but I mean, no problem at all.
That's good. Because
Yeah,
that's
I was pretty
probably
impressed.
where I could fill some holes.
Yeah, they have a lot of back stock, and that seems to be the easiest place to go and get them, and they're discounted. Most of them are $2.99.
Yeah. Because I really like this. I didn't realize how much I did. But I'm reading this in the trade that I picked up, which has the first 4 issues. And they're kind of hard to come by in terms of trying to find these in the wild, because a lot of people don't stock them because of the adult content and the low print runs, so.
Yeah, because the first place that I looked was mycomicshop.com, and I mean, they had almost nothing.
Yeah, what got
I'm
me
like, well,
back
this isn't
into
going
it
to
was
be.
a Kickstarter, is I read one of his, I don't know, there was some kind of trade I got, and then I realized it was a collected edition of the singles, so I just got back into the singles, and I like it. I like it quite a bit, and I've always liked the balance art. Because I have all his entire he's known for Catwoman, and
Yeah.
his art is gorgeous in this.
That's
But
cool.
I do miss the back matter, because if you get the singles, there's all kinds of like Wiccan and stuff like stuff in it.
Yeah,
That's
I was looking through
kind of
that stuff.
interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
It's real witchcraft.
Yep. It is interesting though.
Yeah, it is. It's quite interesting. So
Yeah, for
that's what
sure.
I had, Tarot number 2 by Jim Ballant.
That's cool. Chris, do you want me to go next?
Sure,
Or
you
do you want
can.
to go? Yeah?
That's
Okay.
fine.
All right. My first one is the Twilight Avenger number 1 from Eternity Comics. And this was from 1988.
What made you get this? Is this something you got from Joe?
No, I went to the mall that's right near my house, and it's almost entirely vacant at this point. But one of the places is like a big, used bookstore,
Yeah.
and they have a comic book section where the comic books are $1.25, but if you get two, you get the third for free. So I'm like, free comics for $2.50, that's a pretty good deal. There are all these older, you know, older comics, and I looked at this one. I liked the design on the of the Twilight Adventure on the cover.
Is it a black and white or is it
Oh
color?
yeah, it's black and white.
Yeah. What number was this one?
Yeah, from Eternity.
Yeah.
On the cover, he's being surrounded by, it looks like zombie creatures. He's up on a hill with a cemetery cross behind him. I'm not familiar with these names, but John Woolley is the writer and Terry Tidwell is the penciler. And they do mention right on the inside cover that they had this is not his first appearance. They were publishing a 4-part series with Elite Comics 2 years prior in 1986, and they managed to get 2 issues out before Elite Comics went out of business, and so now they're this isn't a reprint, it's a new story, but they are going to publish. I don't know if they ever did, but they said they were going to publish a full-length graphic novel that included all all four issues of the original series from 1986. So I haven't had a chance to look.
Yeah, it looks pretty cool, and it looks like really pulpy, which I like. So.
Yes, very. And they
1937.
Yeah, they make it a point to say that this is like their, this is what they're going for is a real pulp, you know, type of a hero.
Yeah, it kind of looks like a cross about, of some Crimson Avenger and Sandman, like the Sandman Mystery Science Theater. Because he has like some kind of gun that's connected to his belt.
Yep.
Like with gas pellets or something.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Yep.
So it does look a lot like Sandman Mystery Science Theater.
Yeah, you know, I forgot to go back and, I mean, not that I scanned this one, I manually typed it in, but I forgot to go back and just take a look to see how long this actually lasted. Oh, looks like a few issues anyhow, 6-8 issues, so, yeah.
Yeah, and a trade.
Yep, and the trade. That's cool.
Look at that last issue, it's $21.
Yep.
It's probably one of the best
anything there except for issue one.
If Tidwell draws the covers like he does the interiors like he does the covers, I really like his style.
Yeah, it's very good.
His women are gorgeous, like when he has a woman drawn on the cover.
Yep. Yeah, it was very well done.
Almost like a Dave Stevens look. It's it's pretty neat.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm very interested.
It was good. I definitely recommend it. It gives you on the first page just kind of his background because of the fact that this is jumping in after whatever happened in those four issues, two of which were never published. And it just says, you know, that, you know, this guy, Reese Chambers, he's the Twilight Avenger. His fiance had been run down by criminals, and she's in bad condition, in a coma in the hospital, and has been joining him to help him as the Twilight Avenger is his fiance's father, who is a professor, Milton Hirth, and also of late a female reporter, Joan Casey, had discovered who the Twilight Avenger was, and then and now she's sharing in the adventures. So it kind of gives you that background, and then it opens up on a farm in Oklahoma where a old biplane is being sighted, and people on the ground are noticing it, and it comes in low and crashes. They manage to pull the pilot out of the wreck just before it explodes, and they start checking on the guy, and like, oh, it doesn't look too good. He was like, and they said, no, don't, there's no heartbeat. He stinks. And the boy recognizes him as a famous pilot, apparently. Frank King. And the boy kind of runs away because he's a real big aviation fan, and apparently he was a fan of Frank King. So his dad goes over to talk to him, and when they turn around, Frank King is no longer lying on the ground. They see him off in the distance walking towards his burning plane, and you see a close-up of his face as the farmer's approaching him, and he's got flies actually just landing on his face, and they kind of try to stop him, like, you know, stay away from the flames. And Frank King punches the farmer in the face, and so the farmer kind of grabs him, and his arm gets pulled right off. And obviously that shocks everyone. Frank King bends down, grabs his arm and his own arm, and walks away. So Reese, who is the Twilight Avenger, and Joan, the reporter, they start talking, and they start, she had done an article about this, but because it was so fantastic, the editor just put it in the back of the paper and really edited it down quite a bit. But she thinks there's something going on and gets Reese to try to investigate. And he's really not that interested, but he said that he'll talk to the professor. They mentioned that there was that Frank King went with a Dr. Norwood to Haiti and were investigating voodoo, and then they were never heard back from. So they go to the lab, they talk to the professor. Turns out the professor knows Dr. Norwood. They're friendly with each other, and he can't believe that anything is going on with Norwood, because he's, you know, a pretty good biologist. So, you know, Reese is like, you know, there's obviously nothing to this. Joan doesn't buy it, so she goes off on her own to go visit Dr. Norwood. And she goes there pretending that she's selling encyclopedias. And he's not interested until she says, well, I have a lot of, you know, a lot of weird type of reference material as well, like, you know, strange things like voodoo. He goes, oh, I see. Well, why don't you come in? So he hands her a drink. They start talking, and he's like, you know, it's quite a coincidence. I'm an expert on voodoo myself. And he's like, I was just there in Haiti. I was just in Haiti with my friend Frank King. And all of a sudden the door from behind the doctor opens, and there's Frank all zombie-like. And it startles Joan, but now she's been drinking her wine, and she's been drugged, so she falls over and passes out. So they, Reese and Professor are talking, and they notice that Joan hasn't contacted them back. And Reese is like, I'm going to have to go out there to see what's going on. Professor still says there's nothing going on. You know, she's just being nosy. But Reese is starting to get concerned about Joan. So we cut back to the Dr. Norwood's basement, and he's got her strapped to a gurney, tied up, and he starts explaining his plot, where they went to Haiti. They watched a secret ritual they weren't supposed to see that brings people back to life as zombies, and they managed to steal some of the formula that they use. Frank ended up being killed when they were trying to escape. He injected the formula into Frank's body. Frank came back to life, was still aware enough at that point, even though he had died. He was still fresh enough, if you will, to fly them back home. Since then, he's become more and more decomposing and less really able to do a lot of things, or let alone think. So he's basically taking orders from the doctor. And he was able to draw some of Frank's blood and recreate the formula here. So now his unlimited amount. He even mentions to Joan that he's got a bunch of other ones, other zombies in the basement. However, they're all from cemeteries and from morgues. And what he wants to do now is take out her blood and inject it with this formula while she's still alive, and see if that creates a better zombie that is more responsive and isn't falling apart. So he's about to do that. Of course, at that point, Twilight Avenger breaks in, and he releases all of the rest of the zombies. So they start attacking the Twilight Avenger. Like you said, Mike, with his gun, he can shoot like knockout gas and so on. But of course, these are zombies; they don't need to breathe. The gas isn't working at all. So it's really cool. He's like punching them left and right, and these are all decomposing corpses. So he gives one a crack in the side of the head, and the head just goes flying off and lands. Oh, that was actually Frank that happened to. Then he throws another one down. He punches another one right in the chest, and actually his hand goes right through the body, and his hand is stuck while the rest of them are starting to attack. And he's having trouble getting getting his hand out of the ribs of the other one. And in the meantime, Norwood is pissed, of course, and he grabs his knife and he's going to stab Twilight Adventure. Is looking pretty bad when all of a sudden somebody starts calling Norwood's name, and it's the professor. He's like, "What are you doing?" He's like, "Oh, I know this looks bad." He's like, "What are you, this is insane." And so and now that he's been caught off guard, Twilight Adventure goes ahead and hits Norwood with a knockout gas and knocks him out. Now, in the meantime, he had been just before that, he'd been screaming for everyone, Twilight Adventure to stop. And so all of the zombies heard Norwood say stop, and they just stand still, so they stop attacking. Poor Joan is only wearing a sheet that falls off, and Twilight Avenger is very, very embarrassed, and he hands the sheet back and turns around, because of course he has a comatose fiance. And they call the cops. The cops come to pick up Dr. Norwood, and then they're ready for their next adventure. And then there's a little blurb at the end, a whole thing by John Woolley talking about the influences for Twilight Avenger, talking about what happened with Elite Comics and how they only got two issues out, and how like they've received letters from fans saying that they were pretty upset that number three and four never came out, and they pretty much lost interest. And he's like, the issues were done. We just had no way to publish them because the company went out of business. And he's like, "I hope you'll stick with us now that we're with Eternity." And yeah, so this was a really, really fun issue. I enjoyed it a lot more than I even expected. I liked the cover. I bought it for the cover alone. And the story was good. It was a great pulp story.
Yeah, I love coming across crap like that.
Mm-hmm.
I get my eyes light up when I come across a 50 cent or dollar bin with that kind of stuff in it.
Yeah, it totally, stuck out to me because it was just that whole costume and stuff just looked really cool and a little bit different. And this is awesome. So glad I ran across it. Maybe at some point I'll find the rest of these, or even find that collection. Looks like maybe they did end up publishing that, the first four issues.
There's actually right on Amazon for $10. There's it was published by Pulp 2.0 Press.
Okay, that's the one that I see in our database. That's awesome. I'm gonna put it on my wish list.
Yeah, that's right. Chris. It's only $10 on Amazon.
That's fantastic. Thanks for looking that up.
So that's cool that it's in print.
Yeah, really cool. And yeah, it looks like 2014. It looks like that's when they ended up publishing it. If I'm reading our database correctly, I don't know what Amazon says. Yeah, 2015.
Yeah, there's another one, Twilight Avengers Returns, for $10 as well.
Yeah, and I think that's probably least partial of what starts the issue that I just covered. Because if you look at the cover, it's not the same cover as the single, but it's depicting kind of what happened in that in that first issue. That's pretty cool. Yeah, I'm gonna. Yeah, it looks like it only covers four of the six or eight issues that came out. But I'm gonna put this first one on my list for sure.
The John Woolley, like you can do a look inside on Amazon.
Yeah,
and it just shows like the front pages, and it shows John Woolley did a an introduction to the Twilight Avenger Returns, and you can just see the first page of it, and it starts with a quote from Comics Buyer's Guide that says, "After waiting what seems like years for the final issues of the Twilight Adventure, I don't care now if I ever see them or not. All interest in the series has faded. Let this be a notice to all independent publishers that even longtime comic fans are not without limits to their patience.
that's exactly what he quoted in the back of this first issue.
Okay.
Yeah, he was talking. He actually quoted that exact thing, and he's like, of course he's right. It's T.E. Pouncey, CBG letter column. He's like, yeah. He's right. He's like, this was, you know, it was during the market glut of a couple of years ago, and he's like, unfortunately, we made the comics, but the publisher didn't weather the storm, and he's like, you know, we were just as upset as you know, the readers, because we couldn't get our material out. And yeah, that's part of what his whole little letter column at the back was. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, maybe this is just a reprinting of that, or you know, kind of based it off of that or something.
Yeah,
but
yeah, it's interesting. Yeah,
it's cool. It's nice when they can finally like get that stuff out there when like creators have dealt with that kind of thing.
Oh my god, yeah. So what do you got?
All right. So first thing I was going to talk about was there's a whole bunch of Doctor Strange stuff got added to trades, got added to Hoopla, presumably because of the movie coming out. And I was looking at a few different ones, but I don't know if I had heard of this or not. If I had, I forgot about it. But it's a miniseries called Doctor Strange, The Flight of Bones.
Flight of Bones?
Yeah. And it was a four-issue miniseries around the time of Marvel. It was part of the Marvel Knights imprint. And I remember I was reading, I picked up a bunch of Marvel Knights stuff when I first got back into comics, but this might have been like a little bit before then, before I started reading again. But anyway, it's it's written by Dan Jolly. Well, he's credited story and script, and the artists are also credited for story, but the art on issues 1 and 2 is actually Tony Harris, of Starman fame. And I don't know if he just couldn't complete the whole thing or whatever, but the 3rd and 4th issues apparently are by Paul Chadwick instead. But yeah, if you know Tony Harris art, you know, if you know Starman, it very much, you know, is that style, his usual style. But it starts off with a scene, and I like the way that he stages it, because the foreground is a guy at a bank teller trying to cast a check, and issue it. It's clear to the teller that he's changed the amount of the check on there, and you know, we get some back and forth between them about, you know, it's a check from his. We learn it's a check from his father, and she says, you know, I'll need to verify with your father, and he's like, oh no, wait, don't call him, and blah blah blah, and it's kind of a misdirection, because you know, you think this dialogue is what this scene is going to be about. But then I didn't even notice this figure until the second panel. But he's in shadow in the background coming into the bank, and he puts like a paper hat on, like you know, you can make a hat out of paper, and it's it kind of looks like something like in a cook in a diner might wear, old fashioned.
Oh yeah.
And he puts his hand on the shoulder of the guy that's trying to cash the altered check, and just in like a blast of purple energy, he just disintegrates. And then the guy that does this says, I need to take all the money, please. and you know, like I said, he's all in shadow, and by the time he arrives at the teller, there's some flowers on the some flowers that are blocking out most of his face, so we still haven't gotten a good look at him. The second page is there's only three panels, and his dialogue is split between the three. He says someone needs to open the vault right now, and around him we see people are freaking out, running away, and he disintegrates a couple of more people in the same way. And then the splash page, title page, is a close-up of his face, and we see that all the skin on his face is gone. It's all muscle. It's a really cool page. It's almost as if in the very first panel, when he's kind of like, it sort of looks like he's pulling something down over his head, but he must have actually been pulling off his skin, because around his collar, around like the remnants of it, kind of. It looks, you know, like where the skin that he'd pulled off.
That's kind of gross.
Yeah, pretty dark, you know, which is kind of in keeping with the Marvel Knights theme. You know, but from there we switch to Doctor Strange's place, and this apparently took place just minutes earlier to what we just witnessed. And he's, we end up through a dialogue he's having with a young man, in a suit and tie, or jacket and tie. Essentially what is going on here is, this guy's name is Dr. Wilmot, and he's the foremost neurosurgeon, at least in the country, if not the world. And Dr. Strange has done his research on the guy, and he wants his help because he's the motor function in his hands is deteriorated, and he's trying to convince Dr. Wilmot to take him on, but Dr. Wilmot is very shaken. We discover that's because some sort of situation happened. Doesn't seem to have actually been his fault, but whatever happened, it's not spelled out, but whatever happened resulted in the death of a girl. You know, her family is filing suit against him for wrongful death. And so as far as he's concerned, his career is over. Strange has already attempted, you know, mystical spiritual means of trying to cure his malady, and they haven't worked, so he's going to science. And before he's able to convince him, or at least get a verbal agreement from Dr. Wilmot, he kind of Strange clenches his forehead in pain. We get this interesting panel, small little panel, that's all black except for some red shapes, like two, suggesting two eyes and kind of like canine like teeth with some spots of blood beneath it. And then Strange apologizes and cuts the appointment short. Doesn't explain why he has to leave, and just kind of makes a statement of presumption that Dr. Wilmot is actually going to help him out, and leaves. And so the connection between the first two scenes then is that when whatever, what we just saw occurred in the bank, when that happens, that's what causes Doctor Strange to react. And so he heads over there uses his power of suggestion with his voice, which I like the way they depict that visually. The letterer, the dialogue balloons are purple, have a purple outline, still white background with purple outline and purple text, and the text itself is kind of ornate. He actually uses it. We first see it in the conversation with Dr. Wilmot, because Dr. Wilmot starts to remember that he thinks he recalls a doctor named Strange, and starts to remember Dr. Strange's actual past. And so he uses that to override that and tell him he's a doctor of philosophy. He uses it here to basically talk his way in past the cops that are outside the bank. I find it kind of interesting, like stylistically, like Tony Harris seems to like an early American 20th century aesthetic. This doesn't take place then, but like the cops are dressed in, they're detectives, so they're dressed in suits and have hats on. And it's like the kind of, he like straddles that borderline where like it doesn't, they don't look like they look like they could exist in the early 20th century, but they could also exist when this took place in the late 20th century. But this was published in the late 90s. I think that might have been just an aesthetic choice of the artist there. But Strange goes in and investigates, and the takeaway from this is that he knows sorcery has taken place there, some kind of magic, black magic. He reacted to it happening, but the normal remainder, the normal residue, the normal echo of that, he's just not feeling it. He's not hearing it. He's, it's just not what he's used to. So then we switch to a different character, and this is turns out to be Topaz, who has a history in Marvel Supernatural Comics.
I thought Topaz came from Malibu Comics.
Different Topaz, I guess.
Oh.
I didn't know this character. Apparently she was in a bunch of Doctor Strange, but she was created by Marv Wolfman in Werewolf by Night. She was like a later different version of her used in the Marvel Witches comic. But this is a blonde woman.
It isn't George Perez's Topaz.
Yeah, different Topaz, but she's still a young woman in this, she's walking down the street with a friend of hers, and her friend is discussing, some guy that's so great, and when you hear, what he doesn't look like much, when you hear what he has to say, he's fascinating. And Topaz seems reluctant and to meet this guy. We get a little snippet just so we know, Topaz isn't just any, if you looked at her, you might not think she's formidable or powerful, but she's got a lot of mystical power. She's a healer. She's a telekinetic. She's been friends with werewolf. She's traveled to other planes of existence and even fought for her soul with demons. And she's a natural. But she just wants to lead a normal life, despite all that. But this friend of hers, she's been going to these classes for a week or so, and it's apparently not like her. But this guy Jonathan that she's been going to see and meditate with, he just, you know, she's basically talking like somebody that's gotten into, like, you know, a new religious movement or cult or something like that. She says the word paradigm, and Topaz picks up on that as something super new agey, and she's like, is he more like Seven Habits of Highly Effective People type, or is he more of like a chaos theory type? It's interesting, like, the friend, she's kind of behind Topaz. She, like, I can't really tell if it's intentional or not. She seems to touch with one, like, she seems to touch the elbow of a guy that's passing her with her fingers, and there's some kind of energy passing there. We see he's like mumbling master as he walks away, and it maybe was intentional. It's not clear. But they continue to discuss this whole thing, and her friend asks her about whether Topaz is still seeing the doctor, and Topaz says Steven is just they were never like dating, they're just friends. And they finally arrive at a place called Zensational Yoga and Meditation Center, and Topaz is not impressed by this name, but they go in and they're just getting started. And Jonathan he's a white guy. He's like middle-aged, balding, has a mustache, glasses. And they kneel. There's people that are already kneeling and meditating. And so they join, and Topaz, still reluctant, but tries to, you know, tries to get over her misgivings and participate. We get a whole page of like four panels that's just like, there's a close-up of Jonathan's face, and we see then a couple panels where Topaz is sort of in the background, but the foreground is the people that were already there meditating. And the first they're facing forward, and the second they're all seem to kind of be turning towards her. And the bottom half of the page is her in the center, and everyone's kind of around her now. And there's this like swirling design on the floor. And there's just lettering of the kind of weaving throughout the page of the meditation noise. And you flip the page, and it's a real change. There's panels with pink backgrounds and these like pink cherub devils with horns and wings and red eyes, and they're like riding like ostriches. And the dialogue is all like in pink text around the panels, and it's just like this kind of rhyming story. And the next page is a splash page where she's being embraced by these devil cherubs. It says, Lord and Master, heed us, hear us, heed us, give to us your mournful pain, our hearts filled with lust, you feed us succulent the crimson stain. So it's a pretty wild sequence. The next scene goes back to Dr. Strange, and he's talking to his assistant Wong, kind of recapping what he's learned about the events at the bank and stuff, and how he didn't feel anything, and afterward, and Wong calls him over, and Wong's actually sitting at like a desk of with a computer and a bunch of stuff, and he's got a police scanner, and so he's doing like, you know, surveillance and stuff. He heard something over the police scanner that suggests that what went on earlier, there might be a reoccurrence of a similar event. They inject a little joke here where Dr. Strange is looking over Wong's shoulder and sees that his screen name is Wong Shot. But there's a possible hostage situation, maybe robbery in progress. So we see that Dr. Strange takes off. But then we switch scenes again, and then Topaz is with this Jonathan, and he's explaining that they took special measures to recruit her. Whatever happened to her, she seems to be like full on board now. But you know, she points out, he calls something like he says with bringing her in, they've completed the Circle of Apostles, and something that apparently has been in the works for like 12 years. They actually discuss the expected opposition of Dr. Strange and that he's a threat, but whatever Strange just went off to deal with, it was purposely set up by Jonathan as a distraction so they could do whatever they're about to do. And it seems like we get a couple panels of one of those cherub like demons sneaking into a building and like going over to someone that's sleeping. I think that's him like recruiting whoever's going to perpetrate what Dr. Strange then deals with. It seems to be the case. So that must be like what happened to the guy that went into the bank. It seems to be a church. Strange shows up, he uses his vocal power again and learns from a cop that a car got hijacked, and then he crashed into the church and went inside. It's a guy, he's like stripped to the waist, but again, he looks like he's pulled the skin off of his head. He's standing in front of a huge crucifix, and Strange commands him to stay where he's at. And he says he doesn't have any plan on going anywhere. He's already done what he came to do. He says, I know you don't know what this is about, and I think it's already too late, but I'm scared. Could you help me, please? But he turns around and, he's like already starting to burn up. And Strange tries a spell to like a word of command to try to put the flames out, but it doesn't work. The man just kind of like goes up in flames, supernatural flames. And the last panel of the story is just like Strange kneeling on a black background, wondering what's happening to him, that his spell had no effect. So yeah, it was actually really, really good. I think it came out like the late 90s. I thought it stood up pretty well, even today. The next issue looks like it has a very similar feel with the same artwork. And then with the switch of artist to Paul Chadwick, it's definitely a change. But interesting story so far. The trade is like 100 and almost 200 pages. So it looks like it says that, in case anyone's curious, in addition to this four-issue story, it seems to also have something called Mystic Hands of Doctor Strange number one and material from Marvel Shadows and Light number one, number two, and Marvel Double Shot number four. Which seems like it doesn't, I'm not expecting that those are related to the Flight of Bones because they were published before it. Filling out the trade and stuff, but it's kind of neat when they do that.
Shadows maybe that was all the Marvel, all under Marvel Knights, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, that pertained to him. Yeah, I think Shadows and Light was like a Marvel Knights compilation with different stories in it. So,
yeah.
Very cool.
Very cool.
Well, I also have a Doctor Strange. Interesting.
Oh, look at that.
This is volume 2 of Doctor Strange. You're volume 3.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is volume 2. Which is the one I'm missing the most of. Everything else, I have a lot of Volume 1 and quite a bit of Volume 2, but Volume 2 is the longest running that I know of. This is Jim Starlin does the story and layouts, and Anee Brees, who I've never heard of, does the finished inks. This takes place. The opening panel looks really beautiful. It has a Doctor Strange bound by I forget what he calls this, the rings of something, and he has a boar. He has like it's like a version of him that has the head of a boar, which looks really interesting. And he's
sitting
there. Did you
say what issue you're doing?
Number 26.
26, okay.
Yeah.
Wanted to look for the cover.
It has Doctor Strange on the cover coming out of the mind of the Ancient One. And it's got a couple of the villains he fights in here, and then Wong and Clea, who aren't really featured in here, but sort of in the background. Why is there a Doctor Strange boar? Like, I have no idea. But he's there, captured, and he sort of goes back into a flashback and tells why he stopped these priests called the Creators from alternating the fabric of the universe using a device called the Cosmic Will of Change. Well, he defeated them, and instead of helping them, he caused more chaos. And turned them into stars, like not like music stars or no, actually binary stars, like stars, and caused chaos. And when he came back to Earth, it's like a lot of the humans became anthropomorphic, like they'll have a head of a lion or the head of a duck. Or he really caused a lot of shit to go down. And I think that's why he's bound his boar-like self. I'm not sure why. But when Jim Starlin writes it, he writes dialogue by the hoary hosts of Hogarth. Yeah, he uses all that stuff. Like, you'll have all kinds of quotes in here. But he finds out that the Ancient One has sort of come back, and he's trying to track him down. He's like, I wonder why the Ancient One didn't seek me out. Like, why didn't he seek me out? Well, it turns out that Doctor Strange lost time. He thought he was gone for a day fighting the priests, but he was gone for weeks. So the Ancient One probably did go look for him. But there is a being with horns on his head. I think this has to do with he looks human, but he's got like devil horns. He goes to mug the Ancient One. Well, the Ancient One ain't having it. So he threatens him, and he's got all these demons attacking this guy that's trying to mug the Ancient One. And Doctor Strange finds him, and he's like got liquor bottles everywhere, and he's like passed out. And by the sinister sons of Satanish, no. I love the by the crimson bands of Sidorok.
You do that really well.
Yeah, it's fun to do Doctor Strange, but the Ancient One's there as a wino, and he said, "Well, I had to drink to suppress, like, I guess what he's experiencing." So he's like passed out drunk, and they get attacked by demons, which you see on the cover. One's like a skeleton, like from the Seven Voyages of Sinbad, and there's this female that looks like Nightmare, kind of, but her head is very ugly, like a witch. And they attack Doctor Strange and the Ancient One, but they're able to fight them off. And Doctor Strange, there's a mystical vortex coming out of nowhere, and there's this floating eye, which you also see on the cover. That attacks Doctor Strange, which is part of that attack of those creatures. The eye defeats Doctor Strange, but luckily the Ancient One is able to save him and takes the eye into a vortex and takes the eye away from him, teleports him away from there. And then the Ancient One says they have to go to another dimension, and they confront the in-betweener. This is a character I don't know too much about, but he is the separator of actualities. He is the barrier between dichotomies. He is the all-powerful in-betweener, and I've seen him before, especially remember him in the Marvel Universe Mahatmu, but I haven't read a lot
Yeah,
of
he's
the
like one of those like universal forces or something, isn't he?
Yeah, like,
Like eternity and all that.
yeah.
Yeah.
So they go to confront him, and I don't have the next issue, but maybe it's on the app. But this was a pretty good issue. I liked it quite a bit. It was a lot of fun. There was a lot happening in it, and I don't know like what Doctor Strange did in New York, but it looks like it's in utter chaos because of all the magic beings and all the humans that have transformed into these creatures. It looks like total chaos, and he hasn't even turned his attention to that yet, so we'll see what happens.
Pretty cool, Mike.
Yep, I want to read more Doctor Strange for sure. I have all these epic collections I need to dig into.
The next one that I have is I didn't love as much as the last one, but it's probably my own fault, because it's issue number two. I don't have issue number one. I was didn't really know what was going on most of the time, but it's First Adventures from First Comics, and it's issue two. The cover, I think, is fantastic. It's by Barry Crane, and that's what really drew me to the to grab it. I found this in the same place as the Twilight Avenger, and it's an anthology. It has three different stories in it. So I'm just going to cover them kind of quickly. It was really the only one that I really could figure out even what was going on was the last of the three. The first one is they don't tell you even what the title is or what the feature is on the first one, but by process of elimination, because it does on the other two, I figured that the first story is Whisper. It because this it says on the cover it features Dynamo Joe, Whisper, and Blaze Barlow. So this first one is Whisper, and it's by Stephen Grant as the writer, and Rich Larson is the artist. It picks up right with these two ladies have finished, looks like just doing some shopping downtown, and they're talking to each other. They're preoccupied. They miss their bus. one of the lady's boyfriends happens upon them, and so they go, they excuse themselves, and so the other lady stays behind. Then it cuts to an office, and it has a guy that apparently is the president of this company, and a senator is there, and they're talking about some sort of deal that they have. The problem is that I have no idea at all what any of this is or who any of these people are. Like, they're saying
It's a
each other's
problem with
names.
an anthology. It really
Yeah.
is.
Yeah, they're saying each other's names, but I don't know like what they're discussing, like what, like even before with the two women, they're just talking about other people and
Yeah.
stuff. I don't know who these people are. So the senator and the and this corporation head are arguing. Apparently they have some sort of deal, and the senator is also involved in looks like a mobster as well, and the mobster is also has something on the on the president of this corporation, so they're arguing about that. And I think the transitions in this one are a little obscure too. They're not quite clear because you have the senator like leaving the office, and you know they basically have said, listen, you know we're you can't you know blow up on this mobster's deal because it's going to affect me too. And the senator walks off upset. You wouldn't the very very next panel just underneath it is now apparently the senator again, but he's in bed with that girl from that was left behind in the first scene. But you know, so you don't know like what's trans at first I didn't know if it was the same person or if this is just a different more new characters or whatever, but no, it's the senator because the mob boss then comes and interrupts them and says, you know, basically saying that, you know, we heard you're thinking of pulling out of our deal, and basically beat him up and say, no, you're not doing anything. You're, you know, you're gonna stick with us. The woman now suddenly doesn't have long brown hair, but she's got short blonde hair, and it turns out she's holding a wig, and saying, listen, this is all fine what you're doing, but when you get reelected, you're gonna have to marry me. And and so he's like, oh, you know, you still want to stick in with us. Now, why she's wearing a wig, all this, he doesn't seem shocked that she's wearing a wig. I don't have any idea. We go back to the first couple, and they're walking down the street, chatting, and they're chatting about their her friend, the one that was long brown hair and now is a blonde. And they open up the door, or they just kiss at the door. Sorry, he leaves. She opens the door, and the senator is there inside her apartment, basically threatening her. And that was the end of the story. So I literally had no idea what was going on the entire time. Again, you know, my own fault. I don't have number one. The next one was Blaze Barlow, and that's by Peter B. Gillis, who actually I was just looking, and he wrote quite a bit of the doc towards the end of the Doctor Strange second volume that you were covering, Mike, towards the tail end there in the late 80s.
Yeah, I'm
He wrote
familiar with
that.
them.
Yeah. So
Well,
he
this has
wrote this
Kelly
one.
Jones art too, right?
Oh, the Doctor Strange?
No, he's listed as one of the artists on your book.
Oh, I don't. He's not in this particular issue.
Oh, maybe I saw number one.
Yeah, maybe. Barry Crane, who did the cover, does the art in Blaze Barlow, which so this first the cover is Blaze Barlow. Blaze Barlow is the if you're looking at the cover is the little kid in the old school private eye outfit,
Yeah, with the guns a-blazing.
with the guns. Yeah, so. Very similarly, these guy, I'm not quite sure where we're going with this. They seem to, Blaze Barlow, the kid, there's this woman named Nocturne. There's this weird blue Frankenstein creature, and there's this, and I'm gonna just say, like, he's wearing also a private eye outfit, and he's got like a brown, like, melting face. Apparently he's made out of like cake and stuff like that. I don't know what's going on with him. But they pop up in the first page saying, you know, we made it, we escaped, we're alive. So apparently whatever they were doing in the last issue, they had a teleport away, and they showed up in this weird dream-like land where there's all these weird creatures and strange things going on. I see on one panel, I see a little mini, like, Batman, almost like a Batmite. Mike, you're gonna know the answer to this. I can't remember what it's called. Something in the Herculoids. It was a cartoon. There was like an animal that looked almost like a Triceratops. There was this, like, a blob creature that was white.
Yeah, they were the Herculoids,
It
right?
was the Herculoids, right? Yeah, so I'm seeing
It
the
had the
Triceratops
Triceratops with
and
the pointed,
the blob-like
pointy
creature sitting.
thing that shot things out of it.
Yes.
And it had the I don't know, winged creature
Yeah,
that shot lasers
yeah.
from his eyes. And then the two, the I don't know if it was a mother and son or whatever, the blobs that used to go with them.
Yes, exactly. So I see one of those blobs. I see the Triceratops. I see a bug. I see somebody that looks like it's only from behind, but it looks like they're either. Oh, you know what? I think it's Pinocchio, because he's got long donkey ears, and he's got a looks like a real long nose. Somebody with a hat of Galactus, the robot from Lost in Space, and a Jack, get it, Jack in the box. With the head, is of Jack Nicholson. He's got a Lakers sweatshirt on, and he's holding an axe.
That's
Okay,
funny.
yeah, very, very strange.
That's what one thing I remember always watching the games is Jack Nicholson always was
Jack
in that
Nicholson,
court seat, yeah.
and I'm guessing he's got the axe because of The Shining had been, you know, oh, this was in 1986, so, you know, I mean, The Shining, I guess, was the early 80s, I think, but anyhow, so, you know, they're walking through this weird landscape, and they come upon this big building. It doesn't seem to be a surprise to Blaze, and they go in. I'm not sure what kind of establishment it is. It looks like it's just a big party is there. So they go in, and he starts having conversations with the proprietor, and the rest of his group are kind of getting in trouble. That brown man is falling apart. He's literally melting. He's got like a cherry for a nose. And you know, again, I'm not going to go through panel by panel because I really don't know what's going on. But there's another that guy that's on the cover with the brown uniform and stuff. Blaze, for whatever reason, the guy's name is Lord Regalis, and he challenges him, and they're gonna fight, and they just begin the fight where these people zap out of nowhere, and they show up with all these guns, and they call themselves the Apocalypse Squad. So they're apparently for Blaze. So that was the end of that one. The only other one was the Dynamo Joe, and this was by Doug Rice. He was the creator and the penciler, and John Ostrander was the writer. And this one was a lot more straightforward, even though being a second issue. Dynamo Joe is this big, huge, like, Shogun warrior robot that people inside actually pilot, and they've are running out of energy. They've managed to attach themselves to a drifting, huge spaceship that apparently has some parts that Dynamo Joe could use. They did a scan and didn't find any forms of life. They park Dynamo Joe in and they get out to start looking. It's a couple guys, a woman, and this character that's almost like like a lynx or something, but he walks on all fours, but he talks. So the two guys go, they tell the cat-like creature and the lady to stay behind on the battle suit, and they're going to go get whatever supplies they need. They start looking around. It is not an abandoned place, but rather there are other life forms there. Somehow they managed to hide that. And there's two factions on this in huge battle station fighting each other. Of course, the two guys going one way, they ended up with the actual authorities of this particular battle station. The lady actually knocks out the cat because she wants to go investigate. She goes the other way. The cat comes to goes after her, and they end up with like the rebels of this particular battle station, the ones that are fighting the authorities. And it turns out where they parked Dynamo Joe is literally like right on that line where it's the DMZ, and that's where all the fighting has kind of been happening. And the rebels now want the Dynamo Joe ship, and they've set all these photon mines all around the area, because they said if they can't get the battle suit, then no one will. That was the end of that particular story and the end of the issue. That one was by far the most enjoyable because I totally could understand what was happening. Got a little introduction to the characters, and they all had a pretty unique voice, especially the cat. He was very amusing. So this was by far my favorite of the three stories. The one thing that was interesting, as I was reading it, it had a cool ad for, if I'm trying to go back and find it. It's just a black, a black ad with white writing. Let me see if I can find it. Here it is. It just says Aragones and Grell together, John Sable freelance number 33 on sale in October. So I would like to take a look at that one for sure. But yeah, so this was okay. I was lost from 2/3 of it, but the last story was pretty good.
And the art, at least art pretty good.
The art in that art by Barry Crane was fantastic. And I also liked the art in the Dynamo Joe. I wasn't as big of a fan of the art in the first one by Rich Larson. I'm not familiar with him. Mm-hmm. It was still, I mean, it was good. It was good art. It's just not quite to my style. It was almost like a Bill Sienkiewicz, but not as good. But it was kind of in that vein. If you can kind of picture that style, it's a little bit like that.
Yeah. Cool.
Yep. Yeah, it sounds potentially like a cool anthology. Like if you started with issue one stuff on some of the stories.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping that because it was only issue two, that it was close enough to the beginning that I would have been able to kind of follow along. But it was kind of hard to understand what was going on most of the time. But yes, yeah. I agree. I think it could have had much more potential had I read that issue before.
Yeah, because sometimes even in anthologies, they do, you know, put a little bit of a recap to get you up to speed at the beginning of the stories.
Yeah, for sure.
But all right. Well, my other one was also sort of
Chris, you there? Did I lose you guys?
Oh, yeah, I think I accidentally hit the mute button. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought that I lost both of you.
I thought my computer went whack.
I was just trying to make sure you guys are awake.
You were just about to say who you were, what you were going to do.
All right, so this is the So I think this was republished. It's from the Batman Arkham series of trades. This is the Penguin. So it's basically just a collection of, you know, stories that feature the Penguin. You know, from as early as Detective Comics 58 up to some more recent stuff. And I read Batman 374 from around 1984.
That was a good year.
Yeah. This is by Don Newton, Doug Munch and Don Newton, with inks by Alfredo Alcala. So, you know, pretty, a team that was on Batman stuff for quite a while. And it's called Pieces of Penguin. So this is like, you know, back in the days where the Penguin was just, you know, robbing jewels and trying to get rich.
This is my preferred depiction of him physically.
Yeah.
This is why, yeah. I think just because that's how I grew up, you know.
Yeah, it's very much the classic. You know, he's got the umbrella, he's got the top hat and the suit with the bow tie.
And the big round belly. Just, yeah. You know, long nose.
Big round belly, long nose, yep. So it starts off with a little mechanical penguin waddling towards a jewelry store called the Golden Goose. And, you know, it's like they were just, they're planning on getting robbed with that name. So the Penguin, goes up, you know, and explodes, of course. And, the villain, the Penguin, is right behind, reaches in through the now broken, glass window, starts loading up on jewels, and that's our opening scene. On the title splash page is Batman swinging in to the scene, and just as the cops arrive, and he's commenting on how you know, police are getting a little better. They're usually arriving after he's already left. As Batman starts his investigation, James Gordon shows up with an uniformed police. Batman hands over the head of the exploded Penguin device. Not much detective work required here in terms of the perpetrator. So Batman does his usual disappearing act, and our next scene is in Wayne Manor, and it's Alfred and Julia Pennyworth. And Julia is Alfred's daughter. She's a character that, you know, they kind of in recent years reinvented for a more modern era. She was created not too long before this, it looks like. This is a good conversation. The dialogue felt pretty natural, but it caught you. It also caught me up on what's going on. You know, essentially, like, Julia's been living at Wayne Manor, like a temporary situation, she's letting her father know that she's actually got a job, She's been hired at Picture News by Vicki Vale. But she, in doing so, reassured Vicki Vale that she has no romantic designs on Bruce Wayne. Alfred's like, "Well, are you sure that that was wise? You won't regret that?" And Julia says that, he's too arrogant, and Alfred just takes offense to that, and that, Bruce Wayne doesn't care about his money, he cares about people. And she says, he can afford not to care about his money, and maybe he's not actually arrogant, but he's definitely aloof. And she's been staying at the manor at weeks, and he's paid very hardly any attention to her. So Alfred thinks, ah, this is what it's really about. And but she says, he's ill-suited to the role of matchmaker. Well, just at that time, the phone rings, and it's Vicki Vale herself. And she's calling for Bruce. He's not available. When she hangs up the phone, it sort of gives us a transition into a new scene. And it's none other but as the door opens, an umbrella, a wet umbrella, peeks in, and it's none other than the Penguin himself. And it's after hours. She's working late, and basically he's there. He wants her to take pictures of him to sort of change his image. He feels like he's seen as sort of comical, as a the media portrays him as a bumbler. He's constantly getting beat by the Batman, and he's pulled off a bunch of crimes before the Batman catches him just once. And she points out, well, that's because when the Batman wins, it's always the end of the story, essentially, which makes him mad. But in the end, she basically, he keeps pressuring her to take pictures. She secretly takes one for her own purposes, but she, as far as he knows, refuses to, be his PR person, basically. So we see him, really struggling with his anger, but he just leaves. And she goes to develop this secret photo she'd taken, and it's actually exactly what he wanted. She took it from a low angle because she took it secretly with a, real camera, because this is the 1980s. But it actually comes out very dramatic with the low lighting and everything. He looks rather menacing. And she's, thinks about how it's a great photo, but if she actually publishes it, she'll be kind of giving him what he wants. So then there's like a society bash, another some men break in, and there's another robbery. Batman and Robin, this is Jason Todd, show up, and Jason notices that the Penguin is outside just sitting on a bench, feeding pigeons. And so they go out to confront him, of course, and Robin searches him. Penguin just laughs that it tickles, and they don't have anything to pin on him. They leave, but Batman says, "I know you're behind this. I'm gonna catch you, of course, blah blah blah." And as they leave, Penguin uses a communications device and his umbrella to communicate with his henchmen, and that, the hidden assets are coming home to roost, in fact. So we get a kind of an amusing scene at police headquarters where between Gordon and Bullock. And Bullock is trying to hang a frame around a bullet hole in the wall. Apparently someone in a previous issue had taken a shot at him, And so he's framing the hole in the wall that when that happened. He, of course, he's Bullock, so he slams his thumb with the hammer. You know, and there's he seems to be really focused on figuring out who took the shot at him, and then but we actually find out by turning the page that it was the mayor of Gotham. He's talking to some henchmen that were supposed to have killed Bullock, and the henchmen, you know, they're claiming they actually saw him hit the floor, and but Bullock has been since seen. So checking in kind of with some subplots, it seems like. Then we go to a another social event. This is like a gathering of reporters that there's been some mention earlier in the issue about, and there's Vicky Vale is there. There's also a fellow named Bill Modell who's talking about some, like, he's got this scoop, he's got research that he's done, and he's done a piece on it about the Pentagon and their budget, but he's got some information related to that that people are worried he might publish. And Bruce Wayne arrives, and he's got Julia Pennyworth with him. Vicky's not pleased to see that they've arrived together. but, you know, Bruce is just talking about how, you know, they were both invited and they're both coming from the same place. So, you know, they're not really coming together. They're just, they came together because they're logically makes sense. But Vicky's not pleased. This Bill, this other reporter, he comes up to her and, you know, he says, "Hey, I've heard, you know, you're sitting on something as well." And he ends up telling her a little bit about his situation, and it's even more complex than hers. It involves political stuff in that. And he starts to hit on her, asked her if she's ever left one of her own parties early. Meanwhile, Bruce and Julia are talking, and Bruce is wondering why Vicky's trying to make him jealous. And, then Julia says something about, she's talking about a woman's blood warming and her skin tingling at the mere sight of a man, something she's not felt in Gotham until tonight. And he's like, "Oh, you don't say." but then these conversations are interrupted. Some might be like a waiter. I think it's like one of the classic situations where the staff of a party is being replaced. He opens an umbrella and sticks it out the window, and that's his signal to the Penguin, who comes rappelling in via umbrella in line. He's not after Jules this time, though. He knocks out Bill Modell with gas from his umbrella, and they grab him and take him out. So they were up to something a little bit different. Bruce slips away in the confusion and changes into his Batman costume. And he spots some pigeons and realizes, you know, the connection there, and he follows them because it's easier than following the car that speeds away with Modell. It leads into a place called Boyd's Bumbershoots. And, you know, Boyd's sounds like birds. There's a pigeon coop on top. birds up top, birds in the bottom, and bumber shoots is a British term for umbrella. Inside, Penguin and his henchmen are they're questioning Modell and trying to get information out of him. Seems like at this point he's already given them some information when the Batman comes classically crashing through the window. Sooner than Penguin anticipated, Penguin lets off some, like a smoke bomb or whatever, and uses his henchmen basically as a shield to give him time to escape. Batman attends to Modell instead of going after Penguin. We find out that they drugged him with Demerol and forced him to basically what he was talking about earlier, that information, of course, that he had. It's some kind of defense, classified defense system. It, of course, is called Early Bird, which may have been what attracted the Penguin's attention. How they love to be thematic. And he's going to take that information and sell it, to the highest bidder or whatever. And so that's when Batman goes to try to catch up with Penguin. Penguin jumps off the rooftop using his umbrella as a parachute. And even though Batman is able to puncture it with a batarang, it's not until the Penguin is just above his convertible and he lands safely in it and takes off. In the epilogue, we get information that Modell is recovering in the hospital, that the homing pigeons were used. They basically put the jewels inside of them. Some of them that they found, some still even had them in there. But this seems to be something that will continue. There's no more issues in this compilation, but that the Penguin's up to something broader. And then we have a one-page epilogue that ties in to it introduces an issue as far as this issue is concerned. It introduces a topic. I don't know if it's something probably was mentioned earlier, but it's the Gotham Child Welfare Bureau, and a woman named Amanda has been investigating Jason Todd. They find out, she found out, has found out about the death of his parents, and that they were murdered by Killer Croc, and that he's under the guardianship of Bruce Wayne. The guy she's talking to seems to be like the leader of the bureau. He's like, well, Bruce Wayne's one of the most generous benefactors of the Child Welfare Bureau. And she's like, well, I hope we're not, going to let that influence our work. And he's like, what do you mean? And she says, there's no actual record of any formal adoption or guardianship papers for anyone other than Richard Grayson, who's now an adult. Jason Todd is living illegally with Bruce Wayne. And the final panel is just Bruce looking in on Jason sleeping and thinking that he failed to stop the Penguin, but he'll always be there for, he's not going to fail Jason. He'll always be there for him to keep him safe.
Yeah, little does he know.
And as we all know, that's completely and 100% what happened. Until the callers of 1-800 number got involved. So Batman could keep him safe from villains, but not the comic book fan base.
Exactly. what was it, by like 34 votes or something like that. It was pretty small. I remember that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was a narrow margin.
Very narrow.
But yeah, one of those things that are ironic in hindsight.
Yeah.
But good issue. Definitely showed some areas where it was of its time. You know, I mentioned a little bit of that one going into it in terms of the, you know, depiction of, you know, it's very, in terms of the Penguin's ambitions and stuff like that, but also just like the, you know, the female characters, like their, all their motivation and everything is centered around a man, you know, and most of what they have to say is about Bruce Wayne and all that, so. But an enjoyable issue apart from that. So yeah.
That's cool.
Cool deal. I don't have
you got another
else.
One?
No.
You don't? Can I do one more?
Yeah, sure can.
Okay. I have the stainless steel rat from
Eagle.
Oh,
nice.
Mm-hmm. In 1985.
I have these.
The Eagle comic.
These are great.
You got that one?
Yeah, I have the
yeah.
whole run of this.
So I only have the first couple of issues, but I read the first one today. I'll just go through it fairly quickly because this is a pretty it's a long first issue. It's about 42 pages, I believe. But it's very, you know, it's very concise as to what's going on. It introduces you to this guy. He's a criminal. You know, he's a thief. He's trying to get away from, this is in the future. So these, police robots are trying to, capture him and he's trying to escape. His name's James Bolivar de Gris. And, he smashes one of the robots. He starts running to escape and, he ends up getting caught by the Special Corps. And so the only one that calls him the Stainless Steel Rat is himself because he's narrating the entire – I guess it's based on a book, a real, like, prose book, which is interesting because this was almost written in that – almost in the style of a book, but it also – because there's so many descriptive captions, there's, you know, also the dialogue in the pictures, of course, because it's a comic book. But yeah, it's just being narrated throughout. Sometimes first person, sometimes in the third person. But it does say the adaptations by Kelvin Gosnell, so it is adapted from the novels, and the art is Carlos Esquera. But anyhow, he gets captured by the Special Corps, gets taken in, and the head of the Special Corps says, "Well, you know what? We want you to work for us." And he's like, "Oh, yeah. You think that's how do you think that's gonna go over once I you know let it out that you're hiring." Criminals for your Special Corps. He's like, oh, it should be okay because all of us are all criminals, including this the head of it. His name's Harold Inskip, and he's one of the biggest criminals in the day. And now what they do is they actually go after other criminals. So that's basically where what the setup is. And then they've got him, they've got, the stainless steel rat, going at, you know, into a, he's got a, basically he has to, get into, this area, this presidential area of this, I guess he's the president of this particular planet. And, they're building some sort of war class battleship that has been outlawed throughout the galaxy as part of a peace process. because anyone with it has a tremendous advantage, and they feel like just having them will cause wars across the universe, and so they put a stop to those. But apparently, these are being built on this particular planet, so he's infiltrating so he can figure out what's going on. So that's what he does. He goes in there. He manages to sneak in with the help of another robot, and he confronts the president in this private suite, and he starts interrogating the president pretty hard. And the president admits to a whole lot of things. They say, you know, you're under arrest, and they even mentioned that the president babbled on for 5 minutes denying some crimes that the stainless steel rat hadn't even discovered. He's like, yeah, listen, I don't really care about any of this. Why is your planet building this warlord class battleship? And he's like, what? What are you talking about? We're building a freighter, but we're not. He's like, listen, I know you're building this. And the robot with him says, listen, the president has been lying 74% of the time, but on the battleship, everything that he said is true. He has no idea. He had no idea about the true nature. So they're like, well, what's going on? And the president puts Rat onto the two that were, I guess, in charge of this, and apparently are the ones that are the only ones that know what they're actually building. And it's a guy and his girlfriend. I think his name was Pepe. Pepe. And so what he has to do now is he has to sneak aboard the actual ship because it had taken off while he was taking care of the president. So he manages to infiltrate the ship. He manages to get to the command center, and he pulls his gun on them and surprises them. It's like the Galaxy Navy is on their way. You're going to be taken into custody, but you're both guilty as hell. And the lady's like, no, please. He made me do this. And she carried on for a bit with that, but he kept his eyes and his gun firmly on Pepe. And she ended up excusing herself. As soon as she did, Pepe starts laughing, and because she's now gotten away on a escape craft, and Pepe's like, listen, she's the one. She's the mastermind behind this. Her name's Angelina, and she wants to be Empress of the Galaxy. So they take in Pepe. The stainless steel rat grabs his radio and says, listen, this is a problem. It's actually the woman who's in charge of this, and she just escaped. So she disappears. He ends up having to search all over the place and, you know, basically, you know, threaten and knock out anyone in these dive bars and everything else that try to get some information and against orders because somebody else was supposed to now track down this Angelina because he kind of blew it. He ends up taking the spacecraft of the person who was supposed to do it. He jumps on board now that he has a lead on Angelina and ends up coming to this other planet. And that's kind of where it ends, is that he goes into the local bar and he sees her in the distance. He's wondering whether or not she actually recognizes him because he had been wearing a full helmet and mask previous, but she's kind of looking him over a little bit different, and he thinks that she saw the flash of recognition in her eyes. So kind of wondering where this is going to go next, and so that was the end of that issue. There is a quick 5-page backup and it's basically a Superman parody where Ken Clark works as the checker of a canning factory, and he watches an endless stream of cut vegetables moving past him on a conveyor belt. His fellow coworkers are Lola Lewis and Ollie Jimson, and and when at lunchtime they witness a lady lady's handbag being stolen, Ken Clark goes into a dark alley. His he takes off his clothes. His fingers find the zip fastener concealed beneath his hair. He unzips his false body, and he becomes Super Bean, and he's like a green bean. So the bean flies and knocks out the mugger, grabs the handbag and gives it back to the lady. The lady can't be any happier. He stands tall and proud in front of everyone else, saying that as long as there are men of evil who seek to thwart the course of justice, there will always be work for a bean like himself. And so then he goes back to the shadows and he zips his body back on. And later, maybe the next day or whatever, he notices with his bean ray vision that a plane is going to be crashing, and it's actually Lola Lewis is up there, so he has no time to run and hide. He has to just unzip right there. Everyone sees that Clark is Super Bean. He goes and saves Lola, saves the plane, lands it safely. And everyone is just so happy. Lola says, "Super Bean, you've done it." And they're at the canning factory. She goes to hug him, accidentally bumps into him a bit harder than he expected, and pushes him over into the veggie slicer, where he comes out and he's all processed and ends up being
Oh
put
no.
into a can of sliced green beans. And that was the end of that side story. A very, very. I was laughing when I was reading that, but Mike, you're right. The stainless steel rat. That was a good story.
I
like I
like the
said,
Eagle comics.
20,
Those are my
yeah,
favorite.
42 pages. That was a big, thick introduction to the character and the story and stuff. And yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Very
So I
cool.
read some three like un more unusual books this time.
Have you picked up any expensive back issues lately, or you've been laying low?
I have been laying very low. I was thinking about it a couple months ago, but between we remodeled the upstairs bathroom and where I used to have my comic books upstairs, because now
Yeah.
Allie and Zach have their own room, own rooms, I should say. So when we kind of got like some tax returns, and at the end of the year, it usually comes by the time it comes, it's in March, we get a like a bonus from the company and stuff.
Yeah.
Usually I'll spend a portion of that, on a comic, a few hundred dollars or whatever, but no, not this time. We used it all towards the remodel, so we didn't have to take out, any type of loan or whatever. We
That's
just
good.
paid in cash. Yeah. So what about you? Have you bought anything lately?
Just the showcase, the first Adam and the
Yeah, I saw you got
Adam
that one.
number one. Yeah.
Oh, you got Adam one too.
Yeah.
Nice. That's a good one to have.
Yeah.
Where did you
I mean,
get that? Same place?
Aaron, yeah.
Aaron? Yeah. Oh, that's nice. I would like to have that one, but any ones that I get at this point, I'm probably going to try to just stick with Flash.
Yeah.
Because
So much
obviously
discipline. I have such a hard
I've
time with that.
just it, especially now lately, it's just the extra money isn't it just isn't there. Between Disney last October and then the remodel, it's like I have extra money. So if I do have the opportunity, I'm going to try to stick to some Flash ones, and maybe at some point there's no reason why I can't get from 105 up, because I have 105. So, and I have 110 and 123. It's really the reverse Flash, and then some of the, you know, very like the 106s, 107s that are going to be a little bit pricey, but I feel like I can get it. It's going to take a long time, but
yeah.
I feel like I can fill the whole collection. I'll never have the showcase issues, but you know, that's okay.
Yeah, I was just curious.
Yeah. What about you, Chris? Get any old expensive comics lately?
Not that I'm aware of.
All right.
Well, nice talking to both of you this
time.
Yeah.
We can wrap this one up. And you can reach Chris at MythMakingETC. I'm at Mike Myers Brunch. And Rob is at Rob Krieger. On Facebook, you could go to Geek Brunch Podcast, click the like button, and we're located at geekbrunchpodcast.com. So look forward to hearing from you. Come on. Send us an email. I didn't even give you our email.
No. Or send some questions for next time, right? For a couple weeks out, we could have some. We haven't done questions in a long time.
In a long time.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you guys have a good one. I got a lot of comic maintenance to do, and I still have to read for tonight.
Oh, okay.
Got another podcast.
Have a good Sunday.
I have to go read some Supergirl. Tom King.
Tom King Supergirl. All right.
Yeah, and Rogue. Rogue's number one.
Rogue's number one was cool.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that one. I like Tom King's, but it like reads like a so far, it reads like a Red Sonja tale, like a medieval tale in space.
The entire thing reads like that.
Yeah.
Because it's from that girl's perspective, not from Supergirl's.
Right. So it's like if Red Sonja had taken a little girl under her wing to get vengeance, kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I get out of it.
Yeah, it definitely was good, but yeah, definitely different style.
Yeah. All right, you guys, have a good one.
Yep, have a good Sunday.
Talk to you soon. Take care.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.